From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Criminal justice policy has been undergoing a sea change in Illinois, as in many other parts of America. Fear of crime in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s led to a boom in prison construction and the adoption of policies like truth in sentencing. That, in turn, led to an explosion in the number of our fellow Illinoisans being sent to prison and for longer sentences, peaking on February 9, 2013, with 49,401 people incarcerated in the Department of Corrections. Fast forward, and in its most recent quarterly report, the department says that number was down to 30,000 people late last year. That's a decline of 39%. As we'll hear later on, there are a number of reasons for the drop, including changes in policing, prosecutorial decision-making, and sentencing. But some say we haven't gone nearly far enough and think the current justice system is beyond repair. As this idea of abolition has been gaining more of a hearing in the last year or so, violent crime has been on the rise too, particularly shootings, potentially jeopardizing the growing bipartisan consensus that the lock-em-up criminal justice policies of the 70s, 80s, and 90s had gone too far. Today we're going to hear two perspectives from that debate. These interviews were taped for the most recent episode of the TV version of this program, The 21st at the Capitol. PBS viewers in central Illinois saw it last Friday night and this weekend. It's also on our website now, 21stshow.org, and we're going to hear the interviews in our program today. I began with Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia. She's a clinical psychologist and managing director of justice initiatives at Chicago Beyond, an organization aimed at helping young people achieve their full potential. But before that, she spent more than a decade working at the Cook County Jail, rising to be the warden of the facility. Because this conversation was taped ahead of time, we're not taking calls this segment, but we'd love to hear what you thought about the conversations. You can send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. That's talk@21stshow.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Contact information is on our website, 21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my interview with Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia. Dr. Tapia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with another element of your professional background. You're a clinical psychologist, but you were also the warden of the Cook County Jail for a time. How did you come to be in that role?
Well, I had worked at Cook County Jail prior to taking on the role of warden for about, I'm guessing 9 years, and developed relationships with many of the administrators there at the jail, including the sheriff. And started working on his team in 2013 as the assistant executive director. And I was responsible for initiating programs specifically for individuals who were incarcerated with mental illness. And in 2015, May to be specific, he asked me to the warden of the institution.
And I'm sure it's no surprise to you, the sheriff there has often referred to the county jail, which is one of the largest in the country, is also the largest mental health hospital in the country, sort of involuntarily in that position. Can you talk about, you've said before that you felt like your appointment suggested that people in power knew something was missing in the way the jail was run. Can you talk about what was missing?
Yes. Well, you know, in 2015, it was a pretty nuanced idea to appoint a clinical psychologist to lead a correctional institution. And many people applauded that notion. And to me, that suggested that the larger society, in their applause, recognized that something was missing. And if you just get the right people in a position of authority, you can fill that gap of humanity. Specifically. And for the 11 and a half years that I spent working in correctional institutions, that's what I tried to do. I tried to fill that gap of humanity. And it was at the end of my tenure, really, that I realized that I, and I believe nor could anyone else, fill that gap in the correctional system. I mean, don't get me wrong, like there were moments where I feel like we felt like we had wins. Like there were moments where we felt like we had reinstilled hope in people, but those moments are fleeting because the criminal legal system has such a deeply entrenched resistance to sustain change.
Is it fair to say you went, that you took that appointment, and you've written about being ambivalent about it, and your father convinced you to take that appointment ultimately? Is it fair to say you believed in the possibilities of reform going in, and maybe that changed during your tenure?
I think when I first started working in corrections in 2006, that is when I really believed in the possibility of reform. But it was over the course of years, and quite possibly before I took on the role of warden in 2015, that I realized that reform wasn't coming easy. You know, Cook County Jail, like many correctional institutions across the country, has leadership that believes in reform and has leadership that believes in the hope and the possibility, but that doesn't always translate to staff, and it doesn't always translate to policy and procedure. And, you know, one of the areas in which I wish I had done a better job during my tenure was truly engaging community in the work that we were trying to do in terms of reform. And that is where I believe you can have some more reforms that will actually last a little longer.
So do you still believe it is possible to reform the system, or are you more in the idea that the ultimate goal needs to be abolition of jails and prisons and the entire criminal justice system as we know it now?
You know, I even though we had some wins, I feel, during my tenure as warden, and I believe the jail, even since my departure, has had some wins, and I'm sure other correctional facilities feel that they have made some changes, those changes don't endure. And the very things that I, as warden, was looking at reforming in 2015, someone was going to reform it in 2006. You know, and so what I recognize is that what was enduring were the roots by which this system was built, and that's punishment, that's disconnection from people and community that affirm a person's self-worth, that's inhumane and intolerable conditions by which we force people to live and eat and commune in these facilities. There was no enduring humanity or dignity. And for that reason, I firmly believe in the abolition of the system, because it causes immense damage to not just individuals, but whole families and communities.
And this is one of the reasons I was so excited to talk to you about this today, is because you're somebody who has been in both of those worlds, right? Believing in the possibilities of reform, coming to think that abolition is the only ultimate endpoint we can reach. And there seems to be a debate right now among people who want to see a better criminal justice system, want to change the way it is now. This idea, can you make space for people who believe in abolition and people who just want to reform at the same table? And you talked about this on a panel earlier this year. You said, you know, in order for us to uproot the system, we have to create space for practitioners and theorists of criminal justice and abolition to commune. Can you expand on that?
Yes. So based on my experiences, not just being a warden of a correctional facility, but also having people who I love and care for also incarcerated, I know that reforms are good. Like, I would not want my loved one to live in the conditions by which many of our nation's jails and prisons exist today. Reforms push us towards increased transparency. They push us towards increased accountability. And I recognize where reforms have fallen short, though. Because when you get those small wins, we sometimes celebrate so much that that's where we stop. And I believe we have to improve reform to move towards abolition, but not stop. We have to keep our eyes on the ultimate community in which we want to live. And that community shouldn't include a system of punishment like we have now. And people who identify as abolitionists, some have welcomed me in conversations and some have not because of my history of being a system actor. And my call during that panel discussion was for the communities to come together, because I truly believe we ultimately want the same thing. And that's to have a system that's rooted in healing, and that healing to start in our communities.
I want to ask you about that, rooting it in healing and communities, because this is another interesting aspect of what you've been writing and thinking about recently. When you talk about what needs to change in correctional institutions, short of abolition, right, jails and prisons, you talk about harm reduction, and not just for the men and women inside, but also the staff and for families and for communities. Can you talk about those connections inside the walls and outside the walls and how that feeds into each other?
Sure. I believe that the traditional notion of trauma is very much so individualized. It's a person's experience of a pretty devastating event and how they deal with it. And what I witnessed and what I experienced in my tenure in corrections was that trauma of the criminal legal system impacted everyone who was touched by it. It most impacted the people who were incarcerated, but it also impacted the staff. Look, correctional staff have a life expectancy that's 20 years shorter than the general population, even though that research is dated, which is a problem in and of itself. They have higher rates of substance use, higher rates of suicide, higher rates of divorce. The list goes on. And so we ignore the impact of the system on the people who work in these facilities. And because each of us, myself, the people who are incarcerated, the people who work in these facilities, each has people who we love who live outside of those jail or prison walls, that extends into communities. And so very much so what happens in these correctional systems impacts communities. And that is my call for harm reduction in these communities. I think people have historically ignored what has happened in jail because there's really been no call for increased transparency. And two, there's really been no realization that community has to be a part of what happens in jails and prisons. And then lastly, because people have historically envisioned people who have been incarcerated as those other people over there. And they haven't really experienced or acknowledged that what happens to people who are incarcerated happens to us, that they are community members, they are family members, they are loved ones. We cannot afford to continue to otherize people who are incarcerated.
The last thing I want to ask you about, you recently had a guest essay in USA Today, and you ended it by saying of jails and prisons that we need to make them, at the very least, we can make them more humane with a mission of healing. How do we get from the system we have, largely devoid of humanity, as you said earlier, to one that adopts healing as its mission?
Mm-hmm. So in my experience and in my time with Chicago Beyond, I have had time to reflect on some of the things that I and my team at Cook County Jail were able to accomplish. And in my reflections, I recognize five key components that correctional leaders can think about and elevate when they consider policies and practices. And when they elevate these five components, they have to keep three key stakeholder groups in mind, and that's the people who are incarcerated, the staff, as well as the larger community. And those five components are safety. We all deserve to feel and actually be safe. Transparency. These institutions have to acknowledge that they have to be more transparent with community, and that does not just mean giving lip service to saying that have partnered with community, but actually letting community members and allowing community members to help in drafting policies and drafting training, stake in what happens when people who are institution actors do the wrong thing. And we also look at instilling agency, allowing people who are incarcerated as well as their families to have the tools and resources that they need in order to actualize the strengths that really exist within them. And approaching people who are incarcerated from an asset-based approach, we all have strengths, and we can't continue to diminish people to a behavior that resulted in their incarceration. And then lastly, connectedness, making sure that we not only allow individuals who are incarcerated to remain connected with community, but also making sure that the institution itself is connected to community, because that's where we get real accountability and transparency.
We've been speaking with Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia, Managing Director of Justice Initiatives at Chicago Beyond. Dr. Tapia, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
More to come on the 21st after a short break. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're beginning today's show with a pair of interviews on the criminal justice debate in Illinois. These were taped for a television version of our radio program. It's called The 21st at the Capitol. You can find it on our website, 21stshow.org. Earlier, we heard from Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia, a clinical psychologist, former warden of the Cook County Jail, and currently managing director of Justice Initiatives at Chicago Beyond. Now we're going to hear another perspective on the debate from Garion Gatewood. He's the director of the Criminal Justice Reform Group, known as the Illinois Justice Project.
Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure, Brian. It's always a great honor to be on the 21st and happy to be here with you.
So I want to start by asking you about the past 10 years in criminal justice in Illinois. It was February 9th, 2013. There were 49,401 men and women incarcerated, locked up in Illinois prisons. 49,000. As of January 1st, that was down to 30,000. That's a huge reduction. To what do you attribute that sea change in how Illinois treats people who have broken the law?
So I think we can attribute it to quite a few things. I think we can attribute it to leadership. I think we can attribute it to a better understanding of the economic values. And I think we can also attribute it to the advocacy community. And we'll go piece by piece on those. It takes great leaders and it takes true leadership to actually reimagine what the Department of Corrections can be. We've seen this massive, we saw those massive numbers you talked about not very long ago, where now in DOC put out a statement earlier this year where it said literally this is the lowest population they've had since 1991. That is massive, right? To see a decline in that population, to see so many people coming home and doing positive things. We've also had leaders who have educated themselves and educated their administrations on reentry and the need for positive reentry. Now, we saw at the beginning of the COVID pandemic that there was a need to really map out what a true reentry system is in Illinois. And it goes to a lot of the work that was being done by the Safer Foundation, TASC, and of course, the Illinois Justice Project and some of our other partners in and around the state. If not for that quality leadership out of the governor's administration and the lieutenant governor's administration to really think about how we get some of those people out of the Department of Corrections and do it in a way that increases public safety and creates public safety for all, we wouldn't be here. So you think about the leadership over in DOC now, freshly confirmed Director Jeffries, the confirmation was just on May 31st. You know, you think about some of his visions and some of the things that he's wanted to do. Coming in from another state and trying to lead a massive department during the middle of a pandemic is tough. But again, he's been at the head of a lot of that change to get this massive reduction in the population. So he's done great in that regard. He has not been afraid to take questions head on. He's not been afraid to have conversations, some of the tough conversations with the advocacy community. And he's not been afraid to be held accountable by the advocacy community. As you well know, Brian, the advocacy community does not have any problem at all holding anybody accountable. And he's kind of taken that in stride, learned from some of the things, and tried to continue to make a positive impact on the overall population in DLC. So that goes to the leadership piece.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, but let me ask about leadership then, because it's not just Governor Pritzker. A lot of this reduction took place under Governor Rauner before him. And there has been this, and Governor Rauner, of course, had this commission looking at ways to reduce the prison population. And there has been this bipartisan consensus in the United States where you've actually seen, you know, the Koch brothers, who are, right, sort of somebody that the liberal groups often point to as like the root of all that's wrong with politics and money in politics. But they have been teaming up with people on the left to talk about ways to reduce the people who are involved in the justice system. I wonder, though, how you rate the chances of that bipartisan consensus on criminal justice continuing, or I wonder if you see the way the big police overhaul that was signed into law earlier this year, maybe that already signals that the alliance is fraying somewhat.
Well, I would think that you could continue to see a massive change in criminal justice reform from both sides of the aisle. It just has to make sense to folks, right? There are things that we've seen in the criminal legal system that have quite frankly not worked. It has been remarkably expensive, remarkably ineffective, and now people are really starting to open their eyes and see the current system and the system we've worked with in the past has been really flawed. So as we think about how to improve it, as you mentioned earlier, the Safety Act was a big step in that direction. Now, the Safety Act encompassed a lot of things, including police accountability, bail reform, sentencing structures, you name it. A lot of things were included in there. And that was by design, because there have been so many things in the criminal legal system that have been wrong. Of course, you may be aware there was a trailer bill that was recently passed through the Illinois General Assembly that went back to look at some of those issues. That is still going on now. So, you know, people are still kind of looking at what was included in there and how you build up from that point. But I think we are at a place in the state of Illinois to be a leader where we talk about, we have some stats say we have over 4 million people in the state with a criminal record. How has that improved public safety? How has that improved our economic viability? How has that helped the state grow? So when we started to ask those questions that people on both sides of the aisle understand, we can come to a consensus. You know, one of the things a mentor of mine told me when I first came back to Chicago, and she said, even when you're having negotiations, she said, be quiet and listen to the other side, because most times, if there's 10 items on the table, you agree on quite a few of them. So knock out the things you agree on, and we can do the harder work later on items that we don't agree. So I do think there is still a pathway to continue to get major things done, because even with the passage of the Safety Act, we didn't eradicate racism. We didn't eliminate improper use of force. We didn't eradicate a lot of these negative things that have caused our criminal legal system to be as massive as it is now. So there's a lot of work that's still left to be done. So people have to learn to work together. People have to learn to compromise, and we have to move as a unit.
And the Safety Act, just to remind viewers, is the big overhaul of criminal justice and policing that was passed earlier this year. I wonder, how concerned are you about rising crime rates? This is something that has been a story recently. Part of me says it's difficult to know. There was, you know, if you follow media, particularly in the Chicago area, in the last year or so, there's been this focus on carjacking, right? And it makes it seem like it's this huge threat. And part of me never knows, is that just groupthink of media coverage or an actual increase in crime? But now we are beginning to see some statistics coming out that crime is going up, particularly violent crime in some places. Does that endanger the push to make a more humane justice system?
I think the rise in crime, or the reported rise in crime, does a couple of things. It makes us ask the question around what is public safety. Now, we've heard a narrative on public safety, and I appreciate that narrative, but what I also appreciate is public safety for all. So what does it mean to have public safety for every community, not just in Springfield, not in certain parts of Chicago, even in Decatur, right? All parts around the state, Rockford, you name it. What does it mean to have public safety for all? What is causing these reported rises in crime? Are we looking at economic downturns, a lack of economic upward mobility? What are the resources and supports we're putting in these communities where we see these spikes? Because I'm certain, because I hadn't seen the data, but I assume that you will see a heavy police presence in some of those communities as well. So there's an issue there, right? If you see a heavy police presence and you see a rise in crime, clearly those things aren't working together. So we need to take a step back and figure out how we actually get public safety for all, how we get the resources and places that are needed, and how we kind of push back on this narrative and push back on this idea that there's constantly something wrong. We have to think about what the root cause is and get to the core of that.
Garion Gatewood is Executive Director of the Illinois Justice Project. He joined me for a conversation first broadcast this weekend on the 21st at the Capitol, the television version of our radio program. You can find that at our website, 21stshow.org.